You're listening to Real A Theology, a podcast that considers contemporary philosophy of religion from a naturalist or atheist perspective.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Real A Theology, a philosophy of religion podcast. I'm your host, Ben Watkins, and I'm joined today by a very special guest, Joseph Campbell, who's a professor of philosophy at Washington State University, and he's the author of a paper called Hume's Refutation of the Cosmological Argument. And I've invited him on today to discuss Section 9 of Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. So, Joe, could you give us a brief introduction to yourself and how you got interested in writing this paper about Hume's dialogue in Section 9?
So I do work in metaphysics and epistemology, kind of, you know, traditional stuff, and most of my work research is on free will, but I also work on Hume. I do some research on Hume, and I've been lecturing on Hume and lecturing on these issues for a long time. And this paper actually is something that just came out of one of my intro to philosophy lectures. It's just, I found a convenient way to sort of summarize the various different criticisms that are given, because of course, Hume's Dialogues is a dialogue, so there are, you know, three different characters, and so there are some, you know, Demea is the one who presents the argument, but then there's criticisms by Philo, and there's criticisms by Cleanthes, and it's easy to sort of see these criticisms as being independent points, but it struck me that they went well together, that they provided a constructive dilemma. I mean, the title of my paper is Hume's Refutation of the Cosmological Argument. And I think he really does show, he gives good reasons why the cosmological argument, just as an argument, is just not very good. I mean, there's, you know, it's interesting in a variety of different ways, but it fails to draw the conclusion that it's intended to draw, which is that God exists, something, a being that we could legitimately call God, as opposed to, you know, a philosophical God or some kind of abstract entity or something like that. And it's that last point, it's like the final conclusion, that I think Hume has serious problems with arguments of that type, and I do as well. And So that's the general outline, yeah.
So let me, for our listeners, kind of give some background leading up to this. So at this point in the dialogue, as you mentioned, there are three characters, Philo, Cleanthes, and Demea. And so Hume has all of these characters playing different roles. And so Cleanthes is kind of the empirical theist. So he is trying to establish God's existence by our experience, and he has been met with a lot of resistance by Philo, who is Hume's skeptic and often considered Hume's mouthpiece, and has been criticizing Cleanthes' argument from design up until this point. And so it's faced some pretty devastating objections up to this point. And so now Demea has stepped into the conversation. This is how the dialogue begins, is by saying, look, if there's so many problems with this design argument, what if we considered an a priori argument? And so he offers a cosmological argument to this sort of conclusion. So a lot of people historically have thought that the cosmological argument, at least a priori versions of the argument, faced devastating criticisms, both with Hume and Kant. But of course, in this episode, we aren't here to discuss Kant. We're here to discuss Hume. And so I think this is a good place to kind of jump into the dialogue as Hume presents it to us. So Demia is worrying again about Cleanthes' argument from design. He doesn't see arguments from experience as being able to establish, very important divine features like the unity of God or his divine attributes like perfect goodness. And so he thinks that an argument a priori is well suited for doing this, and kind of and says right at the beginning that this is one of the advantages of the argument. But Hume,
wouldn't God furnish us with the a priori means of uncovering his existence if he indeed existed? I think that's the gripe that Demia has with Cleanthes' design argument.
Yeah, and so I think Hume does something interesting here, and maybe you have some insight into this move. He's had Philo critiquing Cleanthes' design argument a lot over several sections to this point. But now that Demia is giving one, instead of having Philo being the one who kind of takes charge of raising objections, Hume has Cleanthes does this and points out, look, you might show all the ways in which this argument is useful, but we want to know whether or not it's true. And so demands that, Demia tell us what argument that he's giving. What is he choosing to exist on, I think is the phrase that Cleanthes used. And so Cleanthes gives, or Demia gives, a version of the a priori cosmological that seems to be taken right from Samuel Clarke's famous A Demonstration.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I did read a little bit of the Leibniz, and that seems a little different, although there are some similarities. But it is almost verbatim from Clarke. I think that's exactly right.
And so Cleanthes then Demia lays out, he calls it the common argument. And so by the common argument, he means Samuel Clarke's argument. And so he phrases it like this. I have it written down. He says, whatever exists must have a cause or reason of its existence. And so that's a statement of the principle of sufficient reason. And then he says, in mounting up from effects to causes, we must either go on in tracing an infinite succession without any ultimate cause at all, or must have at last have recourse to some ultimate cause that is necessarily existent. And then finally, he says, in the infinite chain or succession of causes and effects, the whole eternal chain or succession taken together is not determined or caused by anything, and yet is evident that it requires a cause or reason as much as any particular object which begins to exist in time. And so this allows Demia to infer we must have recourse to a necessarily existent being who carries the reason of his existence in himself and who cannot be supposed to exist without an express contradiction. And so I take it that this last part is very, very important, who cannot be supposed not to exist without an express contradiction, because this is exactly where Hume is going to have Cleanthes attack the argument to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I think that last point is really important because, Hume gives us through Cleanthes this initial criticism, which is just, essentially, he doesn't understand how you can get from, I call it a demonstration, not a demonstration. So it's
I saw that in the notes that you sent me.
Have necessary claims and all the premises and then a necessary conclusion. But this starts with a contingent claim that something exists, the earth exists, I exist, is the way the Kant puts it, actually. But it starts with an existential claim. And I mean, the problem with the reasoning is really contained in kind of the second stage of the cosmological argument, which is that, you can mount up all the contingencies that you want, but you're not going to get a necessary claim. You're not going to explain that group, in a non-circular sort of way or whatever. So,
For our listeners, you mentioned a distinction between the first stage and the second stage of the argument. For those who might not be familiar with those two stages, what do you mean by the first and the second stage of the cosmological argument?
Yeah, and I think that this is true of all versions of the cosmological argument, that the principle of sufficient reason is used twice over. It's used initially to, there's something that exists, and so it's deserving of an explanation. So that's the initial thing. And then it's used in the second stage where the explanation cannot be natural or contingent or, within. It must be without or self-caused.
It pushes us in the direction of a necessary being.
That's right. And it's that second stage that kind of is really where Hume and, the Kleanthius criticism kind of comes in or whatever, because I mean, you've already said that from a bunch of contingencies, you can't get a necessity, but then you're also claiming that an existential claim literally entails, with the use of the principle of sufficient reason, a self-existent necessary being. So, there's something a little, out of whack. And in the case of, my research on free will, there's a big principle. There are these transfer principles that get used a lot, like necessity transfer principles. So if you have no control over the past and the laws, and if the past and the laws entail, everything that you do, then you have no control over anything that you drew. So lack of control kind of transfers. And you can think of lack of control as a kind of necessity. But what these necessity transfer principles suggest is that you can't get from contingent claims to necessary claims, logically speaking. You can only get from contingent claims to other contingent claims. If you want to get to necessary claims, you got to start with necessary claims, which is what you have in the case of a demonstration.
And if we were starting with necessary claims, that would be more along the lines of an ontological argument, right? We would be kind of moving away from a cosmological starting point and instead approaching the necessary being from the ontological argument route.
Right. Yeah. And just, you said you didn't want to talk about Kant, but this is something, really Kant's point is that, there's a contention about like self-existence or something. And if there was a self-existent creature, then it would have a reason for its own existence. So there would be an ontological argument available in a sense, if there even were such a thing. So this is the reason why Kant thinks that the cosmological argument depends on the ontological argument, because it's the proof of a necessarily existent being. And now note, like in that context too, like if really, if what you're looking for is a sufficient explanation for, for something, the part of the second step is that what you want is a sort of sufficient explanation for something, but all the collective contingent explanations can't sort of yield that. And what I'm trying to point out here is that very last point is itself sort of, a version of like Kleanthes and Hume's criticism or whatever, that necessity has to be, sort of transferred in a kind of proper way, and you can't just jump from an existential claim to a necessary claim. Might have gotten a little messy there in the last.
Oh no, you're fine. because this is a good point. So, the point that Kleanthes is immediately going to kind of latch on to is that the upshot of Demia's reasoning seems to be that, look, if we were to deny the existence of this necessary being, we couldn't do so without an express contradiction. But Hume thinks that we can very obviously deny the existence of a necessary being without any express contradiction. And so Hume seems to be echoing John Locke here too. So those are who are familiar with the history of philosophy will know that Hume builds very heavily off of John Locke's empiricist philosophy. And so Locke says, any idea barely by being in our minds is no evidence of the real existence of anything out of our minds answering that idea. Real existence can be proved only by real existence, and therefore the real existence of a God can only be proved by the real existence of other things. And so it seems that Hume is echoing this with his, what's often known as Hume's fork. So Hume's fork is this idea that there's two kinds of knowledge. There's relations of ideas and there's matter of fact. And so God's nature and existence is going to be a matter of fact. And our a priori knowledge is going to be limited to those relations of ideas. And so you're just not going to get a conflict from matters of fact that entails the contradiction implied in the relations of ideas. And so his thesis is, by and large, you know, there can be no demonstrative arguments for a matter of fact in existence. First off, do you think that's a fair characterization before we read Hume's actual words? But do you think that that's at least in the ballpark of where Hume is?
No, I think that's certainly a fair characterization. I think that there are, you know, two things going on here. I mean, Hume has, he just objects to the idea that you could give a demonstration of existence. And part of the reason that he objects is because of these Lockean, this Lockean argument that you, you know, gave before. So that's, you know, off the table. And then, but there's really, and so you can argue for really, based on Hume's fork, the incoherence of a conclusion of the type that you get in the cosmological argument. And, you know, but, and this is the way that Hume frames it. And this is the way that I frame it in my paper. I think now in reflection, what's kind of a little unfortunate about framing it that way, not that it isn't in keeping with Hume, it is, it's I do think that there's a more important point that kind of emerges. Like you could get there if you, you know, I think it's really important to realize that Hume's not talking about like a program for establishing the existence of God. He's talking about an argument, a particular argument. And so in the case of arguments, like even if you forget, you know, you don't have to introduce the Humean terminology about, you know, truths of matters of fact versus relations of ideas or whatever. And you don't have to accept that distinction. It's just like the point that, you know, you can't get an ought from an is. And if you attend to that, like in terms of a single argument, any argument that has an ought in the conclusion and just is in the premises is going to be invalid, right? And there's nothing, you know, that hangs on this in terms of like something as fancy as Hume's fork or whatever. It really is just a logical point about inference. If you want to make a necessary conclusion, you can only do it with necessary premises. And if you, you know, reject that rule, there is really an explanation that deserves to be given. So, you know, so, and I think that, you know, that point sort of stays with Hume throughout, even though he's kind of willing to give it up in a sense. You know, and say, okay, well, you don't like that criticism. Let's suppose that such an argument is possible. And then, you know, we have the other criticisms that A, I can get an explanation from the universe or B, why can't the universe be the necessary being if you need a necessary being to begin with? But you see that, you know, that essence of the funkiness of the argument of sort of like, you know, it is kind of like pulling a rabbit out of a hat sort of thing. You're getting something that wasn't there to begin with.
Yeah. So the lesson I think to take from Hume here, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I think this is you're putting your finger right on what Hume is trying to get at, is that there's no conclusion that something concrete exists that is deductively entailed by necessarily true premises. So like we could start with whatever necessarily true premises you want, but they're not going to deductively entail that something concrete exists. And so Hume motivates this with an argument. And so his argument goes like this. He says, nothing is demonstrable unless the contrary implies a contradiction, which seems to be a common ground with Clark. Clark is going to want to have said, look, the denial of this is going to have entailed a contradiction. And so Hume is saying, look, nothing that is distinctly conceivable implies a contradiction. And whatever we can conceive of as existing, we could also conceive of as not existing. Therefore, there is no being whose non-existence implies a contradiction. Therefore, there is no being whose existence is demonstrable. And so Cleanthes pretty clearly, explicitly in the dialogue says, look, he takes this argument to be entirely decisive. Like he's willing to rest the whole controversy just on this one movement of thought. Like, so he puts a lot of weight on this.
Right. But it is also true that the additional criticisms that he comes up with are independent. I mean,
He says we're going to pretend like this doesn't, we'll pretend like this objection doesn't work. And he concedes that for the sake of argument to say, okay, well, look, let's say that there is a necessary being and its non-existence does imply a contradiction, even if we don't know what that contradiction is. And it's on that concession, he builds the next concession, right?
Yeah.
Or next objection. So that brings us to Cleanthes' next objection is, why can't the material universe be the necessary being? And so he cites that there's only one argument really for the contingency of the material universe. And so he thinks that argument is going to work equally well to establish that God's existence is also contingent. So he says, any particle of matter may be conceived to be annihilated, and any form may be conceived to be altered. Such an annihilation or alteration, therefore, is not impossible. And so then he goes on to apply this to God and says that, look, we can conceive of God not existing, and we can conceive of God's properties being altered or being otherwise. And so if it's some unknown quality, which is, you know, making it such that if we denied its existence, it would be a contradiction. That unknown quality might as well be in matter as well as in God's essence. One of the two could be the being whose essence implies its own existence, and we don't have any reason to prefer one to the other. Is that more or less Cleanthes' objection here?
That's a great reconstruction there. Yeah. And
because theists don't like this move. They really don't. People are defenders of a priori cosmological arguments think that it's just kind of obvious that God can be the necessary being, but the material universe just couldn't.
Right. You know, and I think really, you know, the point gets at Hume's, his skepticism about God's attributes. Everybody considers Hume to be an atheist. I've written a paper where I argue that he's a theist, and I can kind of explain reasons why. But his
I think the same thing too. So I take that route.
But because he's a skeptic about the attributes, it's not as if there's a kind of robustness of the belief like the Mia has.
It's not exactly clear whether or not Hume's conception of God is religiously significant or not, whether or not it responds to our religious concerns like answering our prayers, surviving death, promising life after death, salvation. None of these things are part of Hume's
conception. And it's clear if you think that religion's connected to morality, then it has nothing to do with it, because morality is just founded on a whole nother thing. It can be, you know, he does allow for, because morality is natural, and if we were created, then ultimately the credit goes back to God. He does mention something like this when he's talking about moral sentiments. But it's hard to tell with Hume how much of that is tongue-in-cheek or how much of it is trying to please it. But I think what's relevant is, I don't think that Hume finds the idea, if you can get past that first objection, which he couldn't, but, you know, if you allow that there are necessarily existent things, then the universe could play that role. And precisely for the reasons that you were saying, is that it's one of two things. Either we have a kind of entire conception of what that thing is, in which case we understand its parts, and then we can understand them not existing or not being together, and so the thing doesn't exist, or there's a part of the essence that we don't quite understand, and we have to concede that it's possible that, you know, the necessity of the thing is contained in that part that we can't, you know, get at with our understanding. But why can't that be true of the universe, if you consider the universe as like space-time or space-time plus causation, or, you know.
So this is a good place. Let me try to steel man the defender of the cosmological's reply here. So I can imagine a Thomist, someone like Aquinas, who is a classical theist, who, you know, adopts something like a doctrine of divine simplicity. And so Hume puts this thesis in the mouth of Demia earlier in the dialogues. And so I can see them objecting, them saying, well, you know, the material universe is a composite object. It is a composite of potentialities and actualities. And the material, so for that reason, the material universe's essence doesn't imply its existence. God, on the other hand, is not composite. It's a purely simple thing. He's purely actual. And so that's why his essence implies his existence, is because he's pure actuality rather than a composite of potential. And I'm trying to make sure I use all the Aristotelian terms right here. But that's how I would see the Thomist kind of essentially trying to reply to this. Now, I know what Hume would have said to this objection earlier in the dialogues, but what do you think of this objection? Do you think this objection goes through, or do you think Hume has something to reply to here?
I think he has something to reply to. It's interesting because while I was preparing, I noticed, and I was moving my books out of my office, and I came across this book here, and so this is it's The Mystery of Existence. Why is there anything at all? And so one of the co-editors, I don't know if you could see it, is, you know, Robert Lawrence Kuhn. So he's the guy who does Closer to Truth.
Closer to Truth. Yeah.
So it's got a bunch of different, you know, writings from various philosophers, some contemporary, some ancient ones. But there's an article by Robert Lawrence Kuhn. And this was brought to my attention because I saw something on YouTube, What is Nothing by Sabine Hossfeldler. And she's a scientist, but she was presenting a section of this paper that he calls Levels of Nothing. And he talks about nine different levels of nothing. Because when you say that, well, you know, imagine nothing. Why is there something as opposed to nothing? Well, you can think of nothing in a variety of different ways. You know, nothing is just the absence of something, but what are you opposing? And I'm not going to go through the whole nine, but you could break it up into three different parts. On the one hand, you know, because like if somebody said, what do you want for your birthday? And you said nothing, you know, they might get you like a box with nothing in it. You know, you'd open it up and, oh, you got me just what I wanted. But of course, in the box is air, right? There's particles, yeah. There's no objects, but you know, you could suck that all out, right? And then there's still like fields, there are equations. In quantum mechanics, even if you take away, that's why they talk about like virtual particles, because even if you remove all the particles, there remains the truth of an equation that the universe could just arise at any given time, that something could just be created at any given time. It's like a sort of constant that is sort of part of the equations, but that doesn't go away. So, you know, you've got objects, matter, energy. You can imagine all that existing, but maybe space-time causation, that might still exist. How about like abstract objects, possibilities, right? I mean, to suggest that, you know, and in fact, you know, the last level of nothing is no possibilities, which means that the only thing that exists is the one world that necessarily exists, the actual world, you know, so you get this sort of necessitarian conclusion. I mean, interestingly, there is a sort of, we're talking about three criticisms of Hume in the dialogues, but he really gives a fourth criticism that I kind of missed when I originally wrote the paper, which is just that, you know, be careful what you're arguing for, because you could end up with a kind of necessitarianism or a Spinozism. He says that at the very end. And so there are two different kinds of necessary beings that we can imagine. The one, you know, that's the creature of the cosmological argument that Hume wants no truck with, but it could just be a genuinely necessary being like Spinoza's God, right? And there's just one possible world, one result, because all the other is the only thing that can explain all the other stuff that exists, including, you know, abstract objects and all this other, this kind of stuff. But, you know, in my paper, I tried to kind of hang on the idea that just the notion of space-time, you know, you could either think of space and time, it's either going to be over and above the material things, the particles that sort of make it up, or it's just going to be relations between the particles that make it up. You know, that was Leibniz's view. But if it's relations, well, then you could get this kind of explanation that we're going to investigate in a minute, that, you know, that Hume puts forth, that the explanation for the existence of the universe is contained within the universe itself. Or if you think of space-time as something separate, as a kind of container for objects, then yeah, okay, when you explain all the objects, you leave something unexplained. But why can't that play the role of the necessary being? I mean, again, it gets back to that point that you made before. I just don't feel like the content of my belief about space-time, personally, actually, this is true, is all that different than the content of my belief about God. I mean, I kind of am like a Humean theist in the sense that I can accept the existence of God. It's just this sort of highfalutin God of you know, some of these arguments. And I also would want to strip away all the moral claims that I make. So, yeah, but no. So I think it's in there. I think a reply is sort of in there, you know.
I would say, so there's two things that I would say to this kind of Thomistic reply for in Hume's favor is, the first would be to say that the material universe might be the necessary being in the sense that the universal material, the universe itself might be the necessary, timeless, purely actual, spaceless, sui generis, whatever properties. So Alyssa Ney wrote a wonderful book called The World in the Wave Function, where, you know, there's just the fundamental wave function of quantum mechanics is the concrete thing that exists that explains why there's something rather than nothing. And so you would be able to ascribe all of these attributes that the Thomistic thinker ascribes to God. But this would bring me to my second reply, that in earlier section, I can't recall what section it is off the top of my head, I should look this up. Hume makes the point about moving from an anthropomorphic concept of God to kind of this mystic conception of God. And so if we think of God in this mystical way where he's utterly unknowable and he's this purely simple, purely actual, it's not clear that we understand anything about this being. And so I have the section 9 open. He says, it seems a great partiality not to perceive that the same argument extends equally to the deity so far as we have any conception of him. And so he said earlier that this Thomistic model of God is really just another form of atheism, because you've basically taken all of the important content out of the concept of God until the point where it just doesn't seem distinguishable from a non-existent God. And so basically his point here is going to be, look, a God that works in mysterious ways is going to be empirically indistinguishable from an indifferent universe that operates on mindless chance processes. There's not going to be some observation that we could look at and distinguish between those two hypotheses.
Yeah. Not just like empirically indistinguishable, but I would say conceptually indistinguishable. I mean, maybe the latter because of the former, you know, it's conceptually indistinguishable because your concepts depend on your experience or whatever. But the thing is, I really do think Hume believes this. It's like, whatever it is that you're sort of holding your mind in those two cases, there's just nothing, to distinguish between them. I mean, it's not a different thing. And that's why, you know, if you look at the argument that I give in the paper, I had to actually look it up myself. The conclusion is not that, you know, the argument fails. Like, it's not that the argument is unsound. I don't think you could formulate Hume's criticism with that as a conclusion. It's just the cosmological argument does not establish that God exists, where God is exactly, it's sort of something useful, something that we think of when we set out to prove the existence of God. You know, and I mean, it's interesting because when you look at the argument from Leibniz, I think he would be in perfect agreement with Hume in the sense that I don't think he thinks that the cosmological argument proves anything, you know, of any importance or whatever. I think in the monadology, he really just brings it up, I think, just to make the difference between truths of reason and truths of fact, you know, and the idea is that both are dependent on the principle of sufficient reason. But in the case of truths of reason, the denial of some claim will demonstrably lead to a contradiction. So you can explain the truth in a finite way, whereas in the case of truths of fact, it, you know, there's just an infinite explanation. You could explain why I was born by appeal to my parents. You could explain why they were born by appeal to their parents. But you can't give the ultimate explanation if it went on forever. You know, you couldn't give that explanation. It's just not. And now, and this is another thing that maybe we can get to a little bit later, but there seems to be a little shift in versions of these arguments about whether or not the argument is kind of metaphysical, like it clearly is in the hands of Leibniz. He's just trying to draw a metaphysical conclusion of a necessary being, and he's not saying the necessary being is perfect or it's good or is not making these kinds of conclusions that you find in, you know, Gale Press or whatever about the nature of the world based on this thing. It's just that it. A necessary being exists. It's just sort of, you know, that. It's just a kind of abstract kind of nothingness. And then, but, you know, so, yeah, I mean, it kind of puts us in that same, you know, kind of position that really what I want to say is Hume is willing to accept certain versions of it under certain conditions, like if such stuff is allowable. He can't understand how it could work, but maybe he's missing something. So then, but whether or not you could get, you know, that God exists, we were talking about something that's, you know, an item of religious belief, of personal belief, from that argument, from that abstract line of philosophical, metaphysical reasoning, you know, you can get a sort of substantive claim like that. I think that's where he wants to get off, you know, off. Either you can get a claim and it's not substantive, you don't know what to do with it. It's just there's a necessary being that exists. Could be the number two, you know. But yeah, so. So that's the unsuccess. It's not that it's, I mean, ultimately he does think it fails because of that first criticism, which he never gives up. But who knows with philosophy?
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can overcome that. I mean, nothing, you know, I don't know how you can just stick with that. I mean, I should add that I have a little, where my views about Hume get a little odd is I think most people just take his claims about empiricism at face value. They think he actually believes them. Whereas I think he's just saying, look, this is the world we live in. We accept empiricism. Let's see what the consequences of empiricism are, what we can do with that and what we can't do with that. And he was particularly against people like Samuel Clarke, who thought that you could do wondrous things.
People of a metaphysical head, I think is what he says.
Yeah. Yep.
So let me real quickly go over the last two objections to discuss here, because one of them is relevant to the dilemma you raised. And so I want to get to that real quick. So in a very, very quick paragraph, Hume has Cleanthes say, look, we can't speak intelligently of the cause of an eternal succession of objects because something eternal cannot have a cause. Because the concept of cause always involves a priority in time and a beginning of existence. And so if you're going to say, well, at what time is this infinite chain that involves time caused? And there's no way you've got to postulate. So Richard Swinburne does this. He postulates what he calls metaphysical time, this kind of time outside of time where causation is still applicable. And so that it would need. So
does he talk about God's creation like in that context?
I'd have to go back and okay. Visit it. I don't remember exactly what he says because Swinburne's cosmological argument is importantly different. His isn't an a priori argument; it's an inductive one.
Oh. Okay.
And so he's trying to say that look, the observation that there is a universe is more likely, given theism than given not theism. And so he calls that a good C inductive argument. And then the question is, and so it's basically a likelihood judgment, but he wants to know, is it an all things considered conclusion, what he calls a good P inductive argument.
Right.
But I know that in order to do this, because you have to say, like, if God created the Big Bang and the Big Bang is the first moment of time, when did God create the universe? Like, and I think it's a fair worry by Hume. But again, he makes it very, very quickly because he then moves on to another objection, which I think is the more important one. And it's the idea that the individual parts of a whole may be sufficient to explain the whole. And so he gives the example. He's like, look, if I were to explain to you the causes of 20 particles of matter and why they were here, he would find it very strange if you then asked, yeah, but what was the cause of the whole 20 particles of matter? And what really kind of helped me understand this. And it was in one of the papers I read. I can't remember which one, but it was, you know, like, what if a teacher found three apples on his table and was like, how did these three apples get on this table? Well, if you were to tell the whole causal story of how each student brought an apple to the table, there is no further question of, yeah, but why is there, you know, what is the cause of this three apples rather than some other set of three apples or no apples at all? But his point is that, look, once you've explained all of the parts in their entirety, if you give their full causal history, there is no further explanation needed. But I think you're going to want to say, but that assumes that the whole is not more than the sum of its parts. So now might be a good time to kind of transition into. So your paper takes this objection that the explanation of the parts might be sufficient to explain the whole. The second objection that there's the material universe might be the necessarily existent being. And then the other being that basically implying Hume's fork, but not really, saying that there's no necessary being that implies a contradiction. You're saying that any trying to avoid any of these three essentialist objections, removing the worry of any one of them will leave you vulnerable to another one. Yeah. But I'll let you, I did a terrible job characterizing the argument. I apologize.
It's harder to explain. Like, there's a kind of threefold constructive dilemma where you explain all the three criticisms together. And then that's harder to explain. But so let's just, you know, the way I would put it now is, let's think of the, you know, that first objection by Kleanthes that you can't have a demonstration of an existential claim as being, you know, sort of its own thing. And then he moves on, like, if you decide that you're not impressed by that or something. And in fact, in the paper and in the way that Hume formulates it, it is formulated in terms of Hume's fork. And so you could just reject Hume's fork and then go on with the argument, which a lot of people would do. As I was saying, I think that there's a stronger formulation of it, but it is a little difficult to get at. But then if we just go, you know, to the, you know, the other two criticisms, you could just think of it as like, well, look, either the, you know, the universe is kind of like a pile, meaning the stuff in it it's nothing but the stuff in it. So if you explain all the stuff in it, then you've explained the existence of the universe. There's nothing left. It's like the, you know, the apples on the table, the pile of apples on the table. Or if you think that that's not the case, then you are admitting that there's something inexplicable, something that's been left unexplained once you've explained all the sort of, you know, parts of the universe or whatever. But, you know, maybe it's that just means the universe is something over and above the collection of parts, right? Maybe, for instance, the universe is space-time together with the laws of nature. I mean, in some versions, people consider the laws of nature to be propositions of a sort, but maybe they're not propositions. You know, if you have a, like, powers ontology, you could think of the laws as sort of embedded in a kind of deeper way, in a more sort of space-time way. And the point is, we're talking about some very abstract stuff, but it's natural abstract stuff. And again, the point is, I wonder how, like, whoever's, you know, thinking about this version of the cosmological argument, and they come and they have this object in mind of this necessarily existent being, you know, I can promise it's not going to be, like, fully thought out. There are going to be some aspects of it that they don't quite understand, and how anybody could explain, just given everything about the argument to date, right? We're not talking about the existence of evil or fine-tuning or other aspects of the universe. We're just talking about its mere existence. I didn't understand how the object that you consider when you consider, you know, you accept the conclusion of the argument is going to be indistinguishable from, you know, space time or something. We just can't have a conversation on that level. We're not, you know, we're just talking about stuff that we just don't know what we're talking about. I mean, we have ideas, and that's nice, but there's not, you know, and
not a whole lot concrete that we're going to be able to say here that all parties are going to be able to concede.
Yeah. And I think this gets back to this other point that keeps striking me in my new revisit with this argument is that we're talking about an explanation of the universe about, and, you know, if I were to ask you, you know, tell you, okay, so there's, you want to know why there's this universe as opposed to another, and then you get the theological story, do you have an explanation of that? Actually, if that hinges on God's free will, and God's free will is indeterminate, there's no contrasted explanation why there's this world as well as some other world, right? I mean, so depending on how, like, the versions kind of, you know, play out or whatever, it's not, you know, there could be other things that come up. But what we're looking for is, you know, is an explanation. I would say that I trust, you know, the physicists. They're doing something when they're trying to explain the origin of the universe. And so, you know, certain aspects of the cosmological argument suggest that some physicists are literally wasting their time because it's not even possible to do so. I mean, do they want them to give up? Do they want us to abandon this waste of time? Or can we at least admit that maybe they're onto something, and maybe actually we can get more details about understanding how the universe came into formation through physics, even if it turns out that, you know, the theistic hypothesis is true or whatever. I mean, it's still, there is going to be a physical process and part of that story of the creation of the universe, and the physicists can at least get at that or whatever. But there is no, I don't know, if you think of it in terms of explanation, it's an epistemic concept. There's no real understanding that we get other than God freely created this world. That's how it got here. I'll go with quantum equation explanation.
I got you.
I mean, what is, I don't know that there's like a missing, I don't know, I don't see that as really an explanation.
So to kind of wrap up the Hume section 9. So after Cleanthes puts forward this last objection of maybe if we explain all of the parts, we'll have sufficiently explained the whole. Hume has Philo make two more remarks. And so those two remarks are kind of, we've already touched on them a little bit. Philo notices that, look, there's mathematical necessities that a skilled algebraist will notice. And maybe there's some sort of you know, necessity that we just don't, that if we were clever enough, we could find that necessity, and that would be the type of explanation that we would get of the material universe. But he warns, like you said, that like this might be dangerous, because if that ends up being the case, well, then you're going to end up with some sort of necessitarianism. You're going to end up with some sort of modal Spinozianism, where the actual world and every possible world are the same. And so that there is no notion of could have done otherwise. God could have, you know, there is no notion that God could, you know, God created because he had to create something. And that you're going to end up with doctrines that are very clearly intentional with clearly in tension with theological doctrines. And then he also puts at the end, like, I can't help but feel like it's one of Hume's little quips of saying that, look, like these sorts of arguments. And I think he's talking about a priori arguments in general, like ontological arguments and cosmological arguments, is like, look, even people who are religious, who even people who are sympathetic to this project of natural theology, still think something kind of shady is going on here. They're not going to be convinced by this. They're going to think that, you know, hey, look, this is misapplying metaphysical principles where we shouldn't be applying them, and they're going to look somewhere else for their religious doctrines. They're not going to turn to the ontological argument and the cosmological argument. They're going to instead look to their local religious traditions, because you're not going to get anything of religious significance from an ontological or a priori cosmological. I think that's his final remark there. I found it curious. Why does Hume have Cleanthes, you know, kind of bring in the heavy hitting objections, but then Philo gets kind of this little bit of stage at the very end of it to kind of say something, you know, like, this is really dangerous and it doesn't convince a whole lot of people who are already sympathetic with you. So be careful.
Right. Yeah. No, that is interesting. And, you know, there's the whole debate about whether Hume is Cleanthes or Philo. Most people just take him to be.
I take the view that it depends. Like, I think he's all of the characters in some way at certain times. He's more a character in certain dialogues and less a character in others. And his movement between them, I think, is essential to his, what he calls, true religion. So I've been really influenced by Gaskin's paper. I think he calls Hume an attenuated deist.
Yes.
And I think that really captures the view really well, especially for a philosopher writing at the time he was in the 18th century, deism was all the rage.
Right. Right.
And so it just doesn't seem a whole very out of character, and it would make sense of other remarks. I think he famously remarked to de Halbach, you know, like, can you imagine someone who's actually an atheist? And like, de Halbach supposedly like points to all of his guest mates, and there's like, well, look, there's a whole room full of them. Why would Hume ask that? Why would Hume make a remark like that if he were an atheist in good company with other atheists?
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So this kind of wraps up the Hume's dialogue in section 9. What do you think are the lasting themes or lessons that we should be taken away from this passage in the dialogues, and what is its relevance to cutting edge work on cosmological arguments today, like Galen Prus or Robert Koons?
Yeah. You know, one thing I should mention before that, though, too, is I really appreciate the, you know, the handout that you gave. It made me read the dialogue a little bit more careful. And those last two points that you mentioned, I don't really mention those in my paper all that much. But I do think they're kind of significant. And again, it's sort of, you know, and I think Hume is being genuine here. Like, and there is something odd about the cosmological argument. If you think of like, well, who are you trying to address with this argument? You know, a mathematician, you know, who's really the only person who's going to understand what the hell you're talking about, you know, or a religious.
Someone of a metaphysical head.
Yeah, and it kind of shows the difference between the premises of the argument, the structure of the argument, and the conclusion that God exists, which is something personal, something we want to kind of deal with in a different kind of level. But people that are interested in that last part, in religion as a bit of personal advice, they're not going to be attracted to an argument like this. It's just going to come off as kind of abstract reasoning, you know. And again, I think it sort of gets to that point that at most the cosmological argument just gives you this abstract argument for accepting an unnecessarily existent being, but there's not a lot of content to that conclusion, even if you accept that conclusion, and the fact that it can't be satisfied by some naturalistic entity, call it whatever you want. I mean, the universe just like nothing is ambiguous, and since it could apply to a lot of different things. But then the last thing I wanted to say is I do think in my paper I reveal a kind of, you know, this constructive dilemma structure, and I think it gives some good advice about how to attend to arguments of this type. You know, I mean, one, you can question whether or not the sort of broad structure of the argument, something with premises like these, could yield a conclusion like that. And that's an approach that you can make to a wide array of different arguments for the existence of God. They have that similar kind of structure where it's not clear that the conclusion appropriately follows from the particular premises that you have to offer. And then you could do one of two things. You could, I think most philosophical arguments, you can find some way of criticizing it. You know, that's in the case of the cosmological argument, that second move of the principle of sufficient reason is always going to be up for grabs, is always going to be questionable. In different versions of the cosmological argument, that move is manifested in different ways, but it's still equally questionable in each of those. And because of that question, you're left with that situation of, you know, well, it's not clear that the conclusion follows. And if it does follow, it's not clear that it's the conclusion that you want, as opposed to the conclusion that the nerd mathematician who's thinking about the number two gets in his demonstrations. You know what I mean? What is the content of the sort of belief? I think that those three kinds of options apply not only to all versions of the cosmological argument. They get manifested in different ways, but I think they do apply. But they apply to, I think, all arguments, you know, for the existence of God, or can be questioned in that, you know, given that kind of general structure, you know.
So where are you in your thought, since a lot of your work has been in metaphysics, and free will, the question is just there. Where are you as far as PSR type considerations as they regard free will? Because a lot of people think that, look, like if you accept something like of the PSR, that just rules out free will. And Now I realize free will in what sense? In a libertarian sense or a compatibilist sense? I know it's a deep question, and I know I'm kind of throwing it in there last minute. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm filled with a lot of thoughts because I was, you know, I was reading over the Gale Pruss argument and also the Kalem argument, you know, where they talk about the difference between like different types of explanations. So like scientific explanations and intentional explanations. And both of them, even though, I mean, not only is the Pruss Gale Pruss version of the argument, the Kalem version of the argument different, but I think that they have claims that are, you know, counter to each other. Like I think in the Kalem argument, you know, the second stage or one stage of PSR leads to the idea that the universe can't go on forever. It must have a finite beginning, you know?
Yeah.
But if you look puzzle at chain version of the argument, the idea that it goes on forever because you can always have an explanation. And so for Clark, it's like you got to explain the whole thing. Why is there the whole thing? And the Kalem, it's sort of something different that you're left to explain. But there are contradictory claims about what PSR entails, you know, in these two different versions of the cosmological argument, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. But ultimately they want to, you know, swing it to the idea that these intentional or personal explanations are the only thing that would do the trick. And there you're talking about explanations in terms of free will, but it's not compatibilist free will. Okay. The initial question was, you know, why is there this world as opposed to no world at all? Or why is there this string of contingent events as opposed to some other string of contingent events? But ultimately, the explanation, it can't be, you know, if you look at the Gale Priest version, where he actually goes through the trouble in the, it, when it, in the versions I've seen of the Kalem argument, it just seems like they sort of accept that these personal explanations have to be intentional and indeterministic and, you know, whatever. At least in Gale Priest, he argues for why they have to be intentional and why they have to be free. But in the end, the explanation that the cosmological argument reveals in the Kalem version and in the Gale Priest version of the existence of the universe is it's a product of God's free will. Okay? There is no sufficient explanation. If there were a sufficient set of reasons, then it would be deterministic, right? Like, so for instance, if the reason that we have this world as opposed to another depends in part on God's nature, right? Or God's purposes or God's beliefs or God's desires, then you have the same fault that you have with all scientific explanations, which is the idea that the explanandum, you know, or the in an a scientific explanation, the thing that you're explaining always comes after the thing that does the explanation. So if you have the whole universe, there is nothing, you know, before it or whatever. So scientific explanations are ruled out. But so are intentional explanations or personal explanations, as long as you think that there are reasons for them. God acts because of his nature. God acts because of his reasons or purposes or desires.
His beliefs about his aims, beliefs, whatever.
If that's your explanation of the existence of the world, then that does not work. In fact, that God is not possible. Working for the gospel, because God actually is not like that at all, right? So, you know, so then but then it comes down to the idea that, you know, there could be two possible worlds that are equally, you know, possible for God to create. There's just no reason for him to do one or the other. And the reason why he does it is because his free will, right? This is the libertarian explanations of people that give, you know, of human freedom or whatever. It doesn't trace back to the past. It's, you know, it's contra-causal. It just sort of ends, it stops, you know, with the agent or whatever.
A downward causation sort of thing.
But then it's just a brute fact. The world exists as a brute fact that God freely chose it. That's the explanation. And it cannot get any deeper than that, okay? That just does not seem like an adequate explanation of why the universe exists. And in contrast to the kinds of stuff that scientists are offering, it's a joke of an explanation, an understanding of why we're here, right?
Because God, it doesn't make the universe more intelligible. It makes it, in a way, more mysterious. Kind of. It doesn't illuminate with what it adds to the picture. It doesn't illuminate anything, but it's added a whole lot of mysterious more stuff,
right,
to the explanation,
contrary to the aim of explanation.
Yeah,
again, like, what, so I mean, I honestly think this has sort of happened. It's like initially the cosmological argument was just, you know, purely a kind of mathematical exercise or something, and it just proved the existence of some necessary being or whatever. Today, it's treated not as a piece of metaphysics, but it's, you know, authored by Craig in versions of the Kalem argument. He wants to take seriously that this is an adequate explanation of the universe.
Like, is it like it should be part of science? Because I definitely get that feeling from Swinburne. Like, he's like, look, I'm positing God. Like a scientist would posit a black hole or an electron. It's making sense of some observation by making that observation seem less surprising. I get that feeling from Swinburne, at least. Craig. Yeah.
No, I think that's probably accurate, you know, with respect to Craig. It's just, all I'm saying is, like, I mean, what we get is the explanation is just, it's a brute fact of God's free will or whatever. Yeah. So, like, the details of why the universe is here. And again, it's just,
we don't have all that. None of it's available to us.
And then there are things that are, we can't find out those answers to the questions. That's where the sort of mystery part,
yeah, you know,
comes in. And I guess I just feel like if we're evaluating it by the criteria of explanations, you know, that's just a sort of different thing. And I also want to say that I think that that just the distinction between scientific explanations and personal explanations is a little unfair, because scientific explanations are explanations of events. So, of course, events are always explained by previous events. But whatever it is that science, when we normally think of scientific explanations, but whatever it is that these physicists are doing when they're talking about the Big Bang, I don't know, is it an explanation of an event? Well, maybe, but it's not an explanation by a prior event, but it's a scientific explanation. It just doesn't satisfy the criteria of what Craig says a scientific explanation has to be. I mean, you know, let's not, I'll put it another way. Physicists are actually trying to explain how the universe came into existence. That explanation cannot possibly fit the criteria of what Craig says a scientific explanation amounts to, because in that case, what you're explaining always has to be preceded by what explains it. And that's not possible when you're talking about the creation, a naturalistic explanation of the universe. But it's not as if these guys are doing nothing, right? So I would say that our understanding of explanations is sort of wedded to an understanding of explanations of facts, of explanations of objects. And to give a theory of explanation of the universe, we need to just think about it in a different way.
Listening. The music you're hearing is by Chicago-based band Casserole and used with permission. If you appreciate the content and the tone of what Real 8 Theology has to offer, you can show that appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes, which really helps get the word out. You can support us directly by making a small recurring donation to our Patreon. Comments, questions, criticisms, and requests can be sent in audio form to real8theology@gmail.com for possible inclusion in future episodes. We would like to thank our patrons, Tyler Bimrose, Jason, Robin Willems, Ed Atkinson, Kim Butchkovsky, Anthony Lawson, Jeff Rubinoff, and Brandon McCleary.